Well, thank you. Thank you, Robert. And thank you for the opportunity to speak at this ASF symposium again this year. I want to talk about benchmark reform. Benchmark reform is a critical issue to all of us, since it will help to underpin the healthy functioning of financial markets. Much work has already been done in this area, but much remains to be done in the year ahead as we look to transition away from LIBOR. This morning, I'll spend a bit of time reviewing the work ahead of us. A key aspect of this is the adoption of fallbacks. While these are an important part of the LIBOR transition, they also should be in place for a much wider range of financial contracts, including those that reference BBSW. So the end of LIBOR is a certainty. It is critical that Australian institutions, both on the sell and the buy side, it's critical that they're ready for this by no later than the end of 2021. Institutions need to have done essentially one of two things. They can transition away from LIBOR by using alternative reference rates, or for contracts where that's not possible, they can ensure that robust fallback provisions are in place. Doing either one will provide certainty about the replacement rate when LIBOR ends. Institutions that continue using LIBOR beyond the end of next year face significant legal, operational, and reputational risks. And when LIBOR ends, any firms with contracts still referencing LIBOR and without fallbacks in place will face contractual disputes, litigation, and frustration. There is the potential for this to lead to a firm facing financial and operational disruptions. Such firms then risk disrupting financial markets more generally. So we all need to get our respective houses in order. The state of readiness for the LIBOR transition is something that the RBA, ASIC and APRA are all watching closely. And ASIC and APRA have supervisory responsibilities in this area and associated powers to pursue if needed. Our current assessment is that the Australian firms have made progress on the LIBOR transition to date. There is, however, variation across firms, and continued focus and effort is needed in the year and a bit that remains. The Financial Stability Board has recently published a global transition roadmap for LIBOR, and what that does is put a timeline on the steps involved that you should be aiming to meet. In particular, by now you should have identified and assessed all existing LIBOR exposures and agreed on a plan to transition before the end of 2021. And by the end of this year, financial institutions should be offering non-LIBOR linked loans to their customers. By January of 25th of January next year, firms should be adhering to the ISDA IBOR fallbacks protocol, and I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. And then by mid next year, firms should have established formal plans to amend legacy contracts where this can be done, and they also need to have implemented the necessary changes to their systems and processes to enable transition to robust alternative rates. If you follow these steps in a timely manner, your institution will be ready for the end of LIBOR. ASIC, APRA, and the RBA have published a more detailed checklist of the range of things that you need to make sure that you cover in your transition plans. So fallbacks will play an important role in the orderly transition away from LIBOR. These will be necessary in the cases where transition to alternative reference rates for legacy contracts is not feasible. And this is why ISDA's recent publication of fallback provisions for LIBOR is such welcome news. These fallbacks will automatically be included in new contracts as part of ISDA definitions from the 25th of January next year. And there's an associated ISDA protocol to incorporate the fallbacks into existing contracts. Robust fallbacks will significantly reduce the risks of contractual disputes, litigation, and frustration for firms when LIBOR ends. Accordingly, ASIC, APRA, and the Reserve Bank are strongly encouraging Australian financial institutions and corporations that use derivative contracts referencing LIBOR to review and, wherever practical, adhere to the ISDA protocol by its effective date. The Reserve Bank has already adhered to the ISDA protocol, as have some of our major Australian financial institutions. So once again, it's our strong expectation that, wherever practical, Australian institutions will adhere to the ISDA protocol. But the need for robust fallbacks goes beyond contracts that reference LIBOR. This includes contracts that reference other benchmarks such as BBSW. Fallbacks provide important insurance. And if there's one thing that LIBOR has shown us all, it's that we shouldn't take existing benchmarks for granted. So the global central banking and financial supervisory community has been promoting the adoption of robust fallback provisions as part of the broader program of global benchmark reform. This is why the Reserve Bank worked with ISDA as fallback provisions for credit benchmark rates were being developed. We needed to ensure that our local credit-based benchmark, BBSW, was included in the ISDA fallbacks and protocol. In time, the Reserve Bank will require securities that reference BBSW to include the relevant ISDA fallback provisions in order to be eligible as collateral in our market operations. I know there's a lot of good work already underway in the industry towards developing market conventions in this area, including by the ASF. In the period ahead, we'll be seeking views from market participants on how and when we're going to implement this new eligibility requirement for our market operations. Australia's local credit-based benchmark BBSW remains robust. A lot of work has gone into strengthening the methodology underlying its calculation and supporting the infrastructure and market practices. This has allowed Australia to pursue a multiple rate approach to our local reference rates. This means that unlike for LIBOR, regulators in Australia aren't advocating a wholesale transition to referencing the risk-free rate, which in Australia's case is the cash rate, or also known as AONIA. Instead, we expect market participants to choose robust reference rates that best suit each of their products and situations, taking into account their own and their clients' needs or hedging strategies. In some cases, referencing the cash rate will make sense, so floating rate notes issued by governments, non-financial corporations, and securitisation trusts are possible examples. But in other cases, a credit-based benchmark like BBSW will continue to make sense. Floating rate notes and corporate loans issued by banks are examples of this. But as I've said before, not all BBSW tenors are as robust as others. In particular, the one-month BBSW is largely a buyback market. Accordingly, it's less liquid than other tenors, so users of one-month BBSW should be considering using alternative benchmarks, given the lack of liquidity in this market. It's also worth noting that for some products, approaches adopted widely by market participants offshore will have an important bearing on the reference rates that we are likely to end up using here. So regardless of the robustness of BBSW, we can expect to see a shift towards referencing risk-free rates in Australia for some products, if that's the trend that's adopted offshore. Before I conclude, I want to make just a few comments on Australia's risk-free rate, which again is the cash rate. The RBA is the administrator of the cash rate benchmark. Accordingly, we've made sure that the procedures underpinning the cash rate are robust. The details of these procedures are available on our website. These ensure that the cash rate will continue to be published even in circumstances when there are insufficient transactions in the market on a given day to calculate the cash rate based on those transactions. These procedures have been put to the test in recent months as activity in the cash market has on a number of occasions declined below the relevant thresholds. In most cases, the cash rate's been determined as the last published rate based on sufficient transaction volumes. But the procedures also allow for the cash rate to be determined by the RBA in its expert judgment and based on market conditions. So this has ensured that the cash rate continues to reflect the interest rate relevant to unsecured overnight funds. In short, the Reserve Bank can assure you of the robustness of the cash rate as a benchmark. So thanks for your attention, and I look forward to your answering your questions this morning. I'll hand back to you, Robert. Thank you.
Thanks, Christopher. Look, we have quite a lot of questions, so I might just start shooting them at you. Let's focus, first of all, on benchmark reform and the discussions on that theme. The first question for you. With ADIs, and particularly the major banks, now issuing much less RMBS, who do you hope to take leadership on the new issuance side when it comes to transitioning away from one-month BBSW?
Well, I think it's up to all parties to actually play a role. Any issuer needs to think carefully about the stability of their product when thinking about the appropriate benchmark. But also those buying these assets need to be very careful. And again, we just can't assume all the time that all of our benchmarks will be entirely robust. That's why it's important to put in appropriate fallback provisions. But in terms of thinking about whether or not, and as I raised in my speech, 1 month BBSW is still appropriate, you know, there are risks there because that is the one that has the least liquidity amongst all the BBSW tenors.
So in that case, do you think that the RBA needs to take more of a stick approach to encourage benchmark reform?
Well, we have some influence, and that's what we're doing in terms of thinking carefully about making sure that products, if they want to be continue to be eligible for repo operation, that are open market operations, that they need to have appropriate fallbacks in place. So we'll be taking a lead in that regard. But it's not for us to dictate to the market exactly where they should be moving if there are concerns about any particular benchmark and what they might move to as an alternative rate.
Thank you. Is the stalling of issuers looking at Ionia-linked deals indicative of wider stalling on LIBOR transition?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there is, as I suggested, there is good progress being made on LIBOR. LIBOR is the end date for LIBOR, and the problems associated with LIBOR are well understood. And as I suggested, I think of the end of LIBOR as a certainty, not as something that might happen. Whereas what I was suggesting in the case of 1 month BBSW is just that it is a very, is the less liquid and less robust of the BBSW tenors. So I think careful thought should just be placed as to whether or not that's an appropriate one to continue on with.
So in relation to Ionia, would you consider the volume of transactions so far are within the RBA's expectations?
You mean within the, I'm not quite sure about that question. Do you understand whether they're asking about whether within the cash market itself?
Yeah, I would imagine that obviously there are transactions at present.
Yeah, look, we do make comments on a regular basis through products like the statement of monetary policy. So in the SMP, we've remarked about the fact that there have been days where we've had to use the previous published rate or other alternative options. But we do continually get days where we do have volumes which are sufficient to base on those transactions. So that's welcome. That's good news.
Interesting. If the cash rate goes negative and BBSW remains positive, do you think more issuers would look at issuance linked to the cash rate?
Well, I would query the premise that the cash rate would go negative. The governor said quite a bit about this. I can't add much more to that other than to say we think it's extraordinarily unlikely.
Okay. Back to BBSW and particularly fallbacks. What is the risk-free rate we should use or should be used should Bloomberg or another vendor calculate a BBSW fallback rate?
I'm not quite understanding the premise of the question.
I think it's just trying to understand who's going to be involved in picking up the differential and or what's your
opinion? Well, I mean, ISDA is quite specific in exactly what differentials and calculations you should be using for these fallback arrangements. So by just signing up to those protocols and those fallback arrangement provisions, you already sort of, the formulas are embedded in all of those. So I don't think there are further decisions to be made on that. It's taken us a long time for industry and ISDA to get to this point, and they're already mapped out quite clearly there.
Thank you. I might throw some non-specific benchmark-style questions in. When it comes to securitization, what characteristics would private sector securities have to possess for a central bank like the RBA to ever incorporate such securities into their QE program?
Yeah, well, it's not entirely clear that we would. In the first instance, and the governor talked about this shortly after we announced the package in early November of recent measures, including the QE program. He talked a bit about what more could be done if needed, including the fact that we could, if needed, support the market if it was in market function through further provision of liquidity. He did mention asset purchases. So one could imagine that we could expand the universe of assets that we might consider purchasing. However, I would note that it's the AOFM that's been active in this area, supporting securitizations by non-ADIs. And so I think it's very unlikely that we'd step into this space, even if we needed to provide further support to market function.
So in a similar theme, what does the ABA see as the efficacy in separating YCC purchases from QE purchases? Does this not make its intervention convoluted, particularly for offshore investors?
No, I don't see it that way. I think we've been fairly clear that the yield target, we think, is a useful way of reinforcing the forward guidance that we've also provided on the cash rate target. And so by saying that we won't be raising the cash rate target until we meet certain conditions, including moving towards full employment, and we've clarified that we'd want to see inflation actually be within the 2 to 3% range and to be there on a sustainable basis. So that's the forward guidance, and the yield target's just consistent and reinforcing that. But then the QE program focuses further out the curve, and we're not focused on any particular yield. What we do have is just a commitment to buy around $100 billion in AGS and semis over the course of the 6 months of the program.
Right, thank you. Jumping around a bit, I'm going to go back to actually, I won't go back to benchmarks just yet. Is there any prospect of price maker support for non-bank lenders to close the funding cost gap that has been opened up by the TFF? The hot topic at this present time.
Yeah, so I think the question here is whether or not the TFF might be creating competitive distortions, if you like.
That's right.
Well, look, the main thing to realise is that the RBA and the government's policies are focused on lowering funding costs for lenders, and that that's being passed on to borrowers. And that includes the AOFM support for securitisations by non-ADIs. The outcome is that we're getting pretty strong competition for high quality borrowers, and that is helping to support economic activity. But there are many factors affecting competition, and it's not clear how consistent the experiences are across the non-ADIs. And part of the difference might be that some of the customers that they might service are being harder hit than others during the pandemic.
Okay. The Aussie dollar and US dollar exchange rate has been rising since the election. Is this a concern for the RBA? The US election.
Yeah. No, look, I think what we've seen with the exchange rate for the last few months was that I think it came down from end of August on speculation that the bank would conduct further easing of policy. And then we did follow that up in November. And all of that meant that the interest rate differential on Aussie dollars versus other assets in foreign currency terms has declined. So that brought the exchange rate down. Excuse me. What I think's happened more recently, though, is that not so much on the election as much as the vaccine announcements that have been very positive and welcome news has seen risk sentiment improve. And I think that's pushed the Aussie dollar up a bit. It's still, I think, pretty close to our assessment of its fundamental value. And it should be noted, of course, that any response to these sort of positive announcements on the vaccine, well, those announcements are a good thing for the global economy, including for the Australian economy.
All right. I might just head back to our benchmark discussion. Given the heightened level of government intervention and widespread market widespread market disruption during the pandemic, is it really the time for significant changes in benchmarks? If everything has paused, why not this as well?
Well, unfortunately, I think those market disruptions showed us just how fragile some of these benchmarks can be, but most particularly LIBOR. And I think it highlighted that LIBOR is just not a robust benchmark. There is nothing that will compel LIBOR to be continued beyond the end of 2021. It exists because of pressure from the regulators on the panel banks that are making submissions, and the panel banks saying, well, it's for the good of all that we continue to do that to the end of 2021. But I don't see there's a need to stop the planning and the transition away from LIBOR. I think it could be, you know, in fact, the market disruption says we should make our financial system as robust as possible, and moving away from LIBOR is part of doing that.
Right, thank you. I've got a question on climate change, a little bit different topic. Other central banks are making moves to address climate change risk for financial stability. Is the RBA looking into this at all at this point in time?
My interpretation of what other central banks are doing, they're doing that in their capacity as regulators of the banks. And that's not our job. We're not a regulator of the banks.
All right, thank you. I'm not sure if you wanted to have another question related to TFF, but here it is. You just repeated the claim that ADIs are giving a funding advantage versus non-banks through the TFF and SFSS because there are other competitive factors in play. Can you elaborate on this?
No, I mean, the TFF is providing the banks with lower cost funding. I think I just wanted to put it in perspective that to say that there are other influences on competition. I think that's my main point. It's not to dispute that they're not their funding costs are not benefiting from the TFF. That's the whole point of the program. I'd put it in perspective though, because you know, the amount of funding through the TFF is still a modest one. So it's having a strong effect on their marginal cost of funding, but the average cost of funding is fairly modest.
Okay, thank you. Prime non-ADI COVID-19 rates are about half that of the major banks. How can they compete for prime customers if banks are funded at 10 bips and non-banks pay market rates at over 130?
Yeah, so my understanding of the average funding costs for non-ADIs and ADIs, there's always been a gap, and I don't think the gap has opened up particularly since the our efforts through this year to lowering funding costs for the economy as a whole. Remember, what we're doing is lowering everyone's funding costs by keeping interest rates low right across the yield curve.
Okay. In relation to TFF, if an ADI has issues refinancing the TFF maturities, has the ABA considered its likely response to that at this point in time?
So can you restate the question, Robert? I didn't quite understand it.
So I think it's around the term of the TFF. So if an ADI has issues or finds difficulty refinancing its TFF exposures or maturities in three years, has the RBA considered a response to this?
Well, I don't see that would be an issue. Of course, we'd have to see where market conditions are at the time. But the TFF is still a modest size of banks' books. There's still quite a lot of bonds out there. Bonds are in high demand for good quality issuers like the banks, particularly the Australian banks. So I don't envisage that they'll have trouble doing this. Of course, they have to plan all of this very carefully and make sure that they get on this in time. But I have every confidence that they'll be able to do this, including potentially by pre-funding some of it. They might roll out of them earlier rather than wait till exactly the three-year mark rolls around.
All right, thank you. At which point on the curve is the RBA currently seeing the most demand from investors looking at to offload govies and semis?
The bond purchase program auctions have been well subscribed on sort of across most bond lines. Of course, it's not true of each and every bond line, but it's fairly consistent across that sort of medium belly of the curve and further out where we're buying closer to the 10-year mark. There's no sort of significant difference across in terms of demand across those sort of two bunches of options that we're running.
All right. I think we've almost come to the end. I can throw something in which is a bit left field. That's a bit of a joke. Jamaica's central bank recently communicated its monetary policy decisions via reggae music video. Would the RBA consider doing this?
I saw that one. I was very appreciative of that. I had a very fond spot for that video for all sorts of reasons, including because I spent one nice summer while I was studying offshore working at the Bank of Jamaica. I'm not sure if our reggae skills are quite up to it, although we do have some very good musicians in the bank. But we'll let you know when that one's coming. I'm sure it'll get a lot of views if and when it's put out.
Thank you. Look, I think that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you very much for joining us and delivering those very insightful remarks on behalf of the RBA. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Robert, and thanks for everyone's attention.